Previously on X-Men.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to a very solemn occasion. An occasion so solemn, we had to record it twice. That's right, it's X-Men Season 1, 97, Episode 5. Remember it. Sniff.
That's right, Bob. Last week we attempted to record this episode, and we could not make it through. We did not have the proper amount of time to mourn prior to even talking or discussing what happens in this episode. We broke down, and
we wept like children.
We did. And we had to come back a week later and try it again. So we are actually a week out from this episode dropping on Disney Plus. We do have the knowledge of what occurs in episode 6, but thankfully Bo DeMeo was smart enough to know that we would need the time. And
we'd need to decompress.
There wasn't too much revealed in episode 6 that ruins any of what we're going to be talking about here today, or what we had planned to talk about. So let's get into this, Bob.
I would also say, Matt, that mixed in with my grief is a fair amount of anger. We'll get to old Bob's anger. I feel rage, man.
I don't know. I don't know about your rage, Bob. You may need to get that under control. Although you've always have had rage, and I think that is one of the stages of grief, if I'm not mistaken.
That's true. I mean, not only did they take spoilers, my beloved Gambit, from me, but Matt, they had Emma Frost dance with Sebastian Shaw. That's not right. Also, they killed my boy Banshee. Matt, I can't believe they killed my boy Banshee.
Yeah, that's your boy, Bob. That is your boy.
And he's always been my boy.
Yeah. And he's dead now. He's not coming back.
Yep. Never. Never coming back.
Even
never
if they do the resurrection protocols, Bob, he's still not coming back. I'm going to tell you that right now.
Oh, I know. I know.
Yeah. They just don't have a use for him.
They're just going to hang a sign over the resurrection protocols, and that sign is going to say Irish need not apply.
No one wants to watch TV, Bob, with a character that just constantly screams. I mean, just in general. I mean, come on.
I mean, that's because the world is limited and flawed, Matt. And that's why I'm so angry.
Well, Bob, I'm going to tell you one of the only things that threw me off, even from the get-go, just logging onto the Disney Plus app. The thumbnail. The thumbnail to this episode.
Where did the thumbnail touch you, Matt?
Yeah, exactly, Bob. The thumbnail was a little picture of Nightcrawler and Gambit and Rogue, and they're just happy as can be, smiling. And I'm thinking, oh gosh, we're just going to go back to that episode, Nightcrawler, from season 3 of the original run, and we're going to have a little adventure with these three, just talking about maybe what's going on. They're on Genosha, having a great time. That's not what happened.
I will say, though, before we get into the sadness, we did just release our episode on Patreon where we cover that Nightcrawler episode. A lot of great discussion. A lot of discussion about what Wolverine is doing on this vacation with Gambit and Rogue. A lot of discussion about Rogue's. I'm going to argue she seems to have a performance fetish, and she's very happy about being in front of all the monks, not just Nightcrawler. So a lot going on in that episode. A lot to unpack, and we unpack it all, folks. We don't leave anything in the bag.
And if you remember the Nightcrawler episode as a child and you just listened to what Bob said, yeah, it's a lot different as an adult. So go back and watch it again and then listen to her.
Also, you see Wolverine accept Jesus Christ into his heart as his personal Lord and Savior.
Which was really big back in the 90s.
It's the most 90s thing you could do in a cartoon, it turns out. Oh, man. But that actually was a great moment. This is skipping ahead a little in this episode, but they really like staged Nightcrawler springing in as a surprise, teleporting in and hugging Rogue and Gambit. And it was very sweet.
But we did also get Nightcrawler in our opening credits this time around, Bob. So we got a little scene of him. And I had predicted, Bob, I want to say, in our original recording, before we started breaking down.
But to clarify for people, though, we saw clips of Nightcrawler in where they bury the clips in the opening credits. For episode 5, we saw clips of Nightcrawler.
Yeah, we see him with a sword doing sword stuff with a Gambit, I believe. So I just want to, but before we started breaking down and crying last week.
Like babies.
And weeping for
profusely
for our savior Gambit.
He died for our sins too, man. Yeah. Wolverine needs to accept Gambit into his heart, not Jesus Christ.
That's the real problem. And maybe Genosha, there will be a religion built around Gambit. That would be interesting. And I think I might follow that.
That would be a way of remembering it.
I see what you did there. Remember it. Well, back to what I was saying, Bob. I wanted Nightcrawler to be in the opening crawl with his name there, big and beautiful, and him teleporting and doing cool Nightcrawler. And guess what?
Just like Magneto and Jubilee.
And I got it in episode 6, so I'm so happy. Yeah. It's like I brought that into the world. It made me so proud.
You manifested.
I manifested.
Meanwhile, my boy Banshee, never going to get his name in the opening credits. I don't think he's ever even going to appear as a clip in the opening credits.
Yeah, but we'll discuss Banshee's death a little later, Bob, but I'm telling you, a lot of death in this episode. Whole lot of death.
Before we get to the mutant massacre, as it were, we have Rogue, Magneto, and Gambit all on the Blackbird. Magneto and Gambit are strutting. Rogue is calling them roosters. It's quite funny.
I also really enjoyed Magneto pointing out to Gambit that he is the only one on that jet who can't fly. Because then at the end of the episode, we have Magneto and Rogue flying and dancing together. And who's that odd man out? Gambit, just sitting down there on the ground, wishing he was up there.
In X-Men media, there's an ongoing theme where both lacking flight powers and then in other contexts, lacking telepathy basically puts you in the cuck chair.
Oh, yeah, you're screwed if you don't have either one of those.
Yep, yep. Really, it's Jean Grey is the ultimate it girl with the ability to do both.
You go, girl. You're the one. But that didn't show at all in the previous run of X-Men. But I think in Jean Grey...
In X-Men 97, they get it. They get it.
Yeah. It's all that girl power from the 90s. Maybe Jean Grey was the one who sparked that.
I tend to doubt it. I would maybe give more credit to Rogue and Storm. they're getting Jean right in this series. Yeah,
they definitely are. Definitely. So, Bob, do you realize that the music that was playing when they reached Genosha and is the actual X-Men theme, but it's done with a marimba?
No, that's hilarious. I mean, the music was pretty aggressive, and I did notice the music in general, but I did not notice that it was the theme song to the show.
If you didn't catch that, totally go back and listen to it. It's really a weird version, but you'll start to hear it, and the more you listen, the more, that is X-Men, and then you won't unhear it. That's the best part. And then another
it
thing,
haunts you.
Yeah, and then on the way as they're flying in, Bob, they run into they keep showing all these different mutants that are on Genosha, and one of them is an ice cream vendor. I think that's Bobby Drake. Bobby Drake quit being an accountant and has become an ice cream vendor on Genosha.
That's interesting. I should have taken the time, but my grief and my rage were such that I did not. But I should have taken the time and gone back to see if I thought it was Bobby Drake. I think the idea maybe occurred to me, but he didn't look like Bobby Drake to me. But that doesn't mean he wasn't. I don't have I'm not great with faces.
And Bobby Drake is basically a generic white guy with brown hair. But.
And this is another, since we now have episode 6 as context, I wonder, because they put X-Factor in the credits in episode 6, and I wonder, between that and between the photo I think we saw in the episode before, episode 5 of Forge's X-Factor photo, I wonder if maybe they're not going to do something with that. I mean, I think there's talk online of an X-Factor spinoff. I think that's wrong, right? Like,
I do too.
I don't think that's
not happening.
I mean, I would love it to happen, but I don't think it will happen. But I do wonder if maybe, although Bobby wasn't a part of X-Factor, but he famously his main episode from X-Men 92 did heavily involve X-Factor.
I think they just want to do more with, like, a government-controlled X-Men type, mm-hmm. and that's what they want to go for with the X-Factor piece, and that we'll probably see more of that either, if not later in this season, then next season.
Well, and the other interesting thing to think about is, I mean, sometimes you have Forge lead that X-Factor team, right, with his government contacts.
Right.
But you also have Val Cooper lead it, or at least be its liaison, and also sometimes you have Mystique involved with it, which the current theory is that Mystique is Val Cooper.
I was about to say, sometimes they're the same person. Yes.
Yeah, sometimes they're the same person. So they could be going in some direction with that. Sadly, I don't think it'll spin off. But man, if we could get a New Mutants or an X-Factor spinoff from the show, that would just about make my day.
I will say I'm one of the internet sleuths who keeps trying to look for Valerie Cooper's eyes to turn yellow, but haven't seen it quite yet. And there are people pointing out that sometimes it changes slight shade, but I'm like, no, that's not what we're talking about. We have to see the cat eyes.
Full foreshadowing.
Right.
Not an animation error.
Exactly. Or not just how they're trying to reflect light off someone's eyes using the animation style they have.
So beyond the possible Bobby Drake cameo, these were the ones I was sure about. We see Pixie, we see Glob Herman, we see Nature Girl, we see Leech, we see Madrox, the Multiple Man, another X-Factor alum. We see Exodus, we see Dazzler, we see Boom Boom, and we see Archangel.
Seeing a lot of Grant Morrison-inspired characters here, Bob.
Pixie and Glob Herman are from the Morrison run. I think Nature Girls is from the Jason Aaron run originally, although yeah, I could be wrong about that.
Yeah, and Nature Girl literally just, she talks to nature. What a fun power.
Lately, man, they've been doing a series with her in the online comics, which I mostly don't read, but I've read a few of these called X-Men Green, where Nature Girl basically gets radicalized into being an eco-terrorist, to which I can only say, you go, girl.
That's right. That's right. You go, girl. That's awesome. Although, I do want to say that I read all my comics online.
Well, Matt, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, you read all your comics online, but you only read comics that are also in print.
Well, that is true. I see what you're saying. So these are digital only, digital exclusive comics.
Yes, digital exclusive comics. I believe the series in homage to the one from the 90s is called X-Men Unlimited. It's like an anthology thing, and the X-Men Green is like one strip within the X-Men Unlimited.
That makes sense. Well, I will say this, Bob. We get to see Leech again, and we know that Leech, he used to live in the sewer with the Morlocks, and he has a huge part in the Fantastic Four run by Jonathan Hickman that we've been covering. He's a big piece of the Future Foundation. I had to do a little bit of research because I keep forgetting that his powers, he used to not have any real control over them, and if any mutant was within his range or in his presence, they would lose their powers. They would be...
Yeah, but at some point he gets... I honestly couldn't tell you when.
Right.
At some point he gets control over it.
But I guess he's learned to keep his, like, the net he cast is much smaller now, so that it makes more sense in the context of this. Because I always was in the impression, I guess I get it also from X-Men The Last Stand as well, because he was in that. I think he was a big piece of that movie. And it just throws me off. But now I understand. I have a much better understanding of how he's able to control that now, so that not every mutant that's around him loses their powers. Because that would be the worst person to have on Genosha. You have a nation of mutants, but this one mutant just zaps you clean of your powers. Although you could also make a lot of money off of it, though, as Leech.
Credit to the Morlocks for keeping him around even when he didn't have control of his powers.
Thank you, Callisto.
Yeah. Sorry. Callisto's a good ruler.
You mean was a good ruler.
Dumb. R.I.P. Callisto. R.I.P. So others that were spotted, I didn't spot them, but others that were spotted were Marrow, Squid Boy, WizKid, and Gentle. Do you know who all of those are, Matt?
I know every one of them, yes, except for I don't know much about Squid Boy. I confused him with Darwin when he showed up. I thought maybe he was supposed to be some version of Darwin.
Yeah, and of these, Squid Boy is prominent, but I just didn't recognize him because I'm not that familiar with him. I think he's also like Nature Girl, more from the Jason Aaron era of Wolverine and the X-Men. And then totally didn't see WizKid or Gentle. And then I saw Marrow, whom I like a lot, but I couldn't really make her out. But I saw somebody actually take the freeze frame of Banshee holding Marrow, and it's like, oh, it's clearly both then. And then
right, in the actual episode, Banshee's trying to escape the explosion and everything with Marrow, and that's when he dies. They both get incinerated.
R.I.P. Marrow. Matt, were you surprised Madeline Pryor was on Genosha?
A bit, because they made it seem she was going to go away for a while based on the episode where we get the big reveal and she becomes the Goblin Queen and everything. But I was a little unnerved that she was not wearing her hair down, but it was in a bun. It's not a ponytail, but come on, at least keep it consistent. What is the bun supposed to represent? Because I know the long hair is Madeline Pryor, the ponytail is Jean Grey. Is the bun someone in between? Is there another clone we don't know about?
Well, Matt, maybe we're skipping ahead a little bit with this, but we find out that Madeline and Scott are conducting a little bit of a emotional affair, a telepathic affair, if you will.
Oh, yeah.
Modeled on Emma Frost and Scott doing this in the Grant Morrison X-Men run. But, I actually don't necessarily think this is what the show is going for. But if you wanted to have a pretty sinister interpretation of Madeline here, you could say, oh, yeah, she's trying to be more like the return Jean Grey in order to better ensnare Scott, right? Yeah.
I like your choice of words there, Bob. A more sinister Jean Grey.
That wasn't necessarily meant to be implication, but it's also hard, it's hard to avoid it when you bring up that word, right?
Right, right.
Yeah. Yeah, let's see. So speaking of Cyclops, since we're already on him, I saw a couple people complaining about this, but I thought it was great. Him going ham on Trish Tilby and about how many times the X-Men have saved the world and how he's tired of having to prove that he's a person. Yeah. I thought that was pretty great.
Yeah, I like that his shades were totally messing up the lights and they had to sit him in a different place. They asked him to remove his glasses, too. How awful is that?
That's very funny.
I mean, that's the worst thing you could do. That's like asking someone in a wheelchair to stand up. Can you please stand up for this? Awful.
Yeah, it is terrible. So, Matt, we also have around this time of the interview a scene that I think even more people were a little meh about, besides the Scott Summers interview. And while I liked the Scott Summers interview, I was somewhat sharing the meh feelings of some corners of the internet about the scene, but you noticed things about it that I didn't really think about.
Yeah, so I really like the scene where Jean is digging through her memories beneath the lake. It's symbolic since Phoenix originally rose from the water. We all remember that scene. And as Wolverine puts it, she's drowning in memories. I think she's trying to figure out who she actually is down underneath the water before she comes back up. But unfortunately, though, only one of the images has her with a ponytail when you actually see her memories in the water. And it makes me think you might have been right about Madeline being the Phoenix and doing all the cool stuff Jean Grey did in the original. The only cool stuff she did.
It's also interesting because it is a pretty cool demonstration of power of Jean, right?
Oh, which, yeah.
It's not Phoenix-level power, but it is. She's a very powerful telekinetic, which is not always represented. Although I think the Tom Taylor X-Men Red series, the first X-Men Red series, does that pretty well, if I recall.
I mean, she can literally build an Aquaman underwater bubble thing around them, and you know, it's crazy. And have her TVs of her mind going at the same time. I did catch on, though. I didn't think Jean was too thrilled that Logan rejected her.
Because she didn't seem to be, no.
Yeah, she comes on to him. I mean, she tries to kiss him, and he's, nah, you need to stick with Scott. He's your man.
It's interesting that we're doing the three-way or the triangle, although we've expanded it to a quadrangle. But it's also Wolverine. He's not super into it, right? He's more comfortable with being like in the cuck chair, even though he's not really in the cuck chair because he's not being cucked. He's more comfortable being outside.
So what you're saying, Bob, is literally everyone can be satisfied, but absolutely no one is happy.
Oh man, I don't think they would ever let Bo DeMeo or somebody else do it, but it really would be nice if we could just get to the Jonathan Hickman solution, which sadly was really only suggested at and never expanded on, but of just have the happy three-way between them. It's such a nice, elegant solution.
I mean, and having read that whole run, Bob, literally, it's just a door. That's it. One door in one graphic.
It's also the scene in the party where Wolverine has his arms draped around both of them.
Yeah.
And there's a scene early in, not in House of X and Powers of 10, but in Hickman's later X-Men scene, or X-Men comic series. Yes. There's a scene where Wolverine and Cyclops are flirting, and Wolverine is talking about seeing Cyclops in a bikini on a beach.
Okay. Well, at least there's two other... Okay, but I will say this, though, Bob.
And they're literally cohabitating.
To make it clear, there's a diagram of what Cyclops' house on the moon, and they share... there's three rooms, and each one shares doors. They all share doors.
Jean's is in the middle, and it has direct doors to Scott's and Logan's. Yes.
Just in case the Phoenix Force rises up and Wolverine can go in there and stab her. That's all it is, Bob. It's nothing else.
That's all. He's just on stabbing duty. No, not that stabbing duty. The other stabbing duty. So, Matt, who was on the Genosha Council for this episode?
Well, Bob, we get a veritable who's who of mutants and people that just... It's pretty exciting. You get Sebastian Shaw, Callisto, Madeline Pryor, Banshee, Myra McTaggart, and Emma Frost.
Yeah. And they do make a lot of Moira being the human on the council, which honestly is an interesting idea. It's something that the Krakoa era X-Men didn't really play with, but had they gone there, could have been interesting. And I especially like Emma has a lot of cheap digs in Moira and Val this episode that were just absolutely delightful. As annoyed as I am that she danced with Sebastian Shaw, I did think they got her catty personality very well. So she says about Moira, "Were no other humans available to weep over semantics?"
Yeah, exactly. And I can't look at Myra McTaggart without thinking she's going to cause some major trouble if they ever want to go and adapt the Krakoan era.
Yeah, that could be fun. That could be fun. Yeah. So, Matt, I did have a minor but to me important question. Does that statue of Xavier on Genosha, does it look like Lenin?
Bob, I saw a statue that size of Lenin in Moscow. At least this statue of Xavier is somewhat welcoming. He has his hands open. Come. The one in Moscow did not look like that. But my question, too, is why is there a statue of Xavier? Was it Magneto the big guy on Genosha?
I have a hard time keeping the finale sticking in my memory. All I really remember is Xavier's dying speech to each of the mutants, which is the worst part of the episode. But I think the implication was, I don't know if we saw the statues in that finale, but, I mean, the implication was that Magneto had built up Genosha, and I think he built the statue of himself and the statue of his boy, Charles. I think that's the implication.
Okay, so he just wanted to honor Xavier, even though they have diametrically opposed ideologies.
Or the other way you could read it is he wanted a statue of himself, but he knows that looks like supervillain stuff, so what if I put a statue of my best friend who hates me? How does that make it work?
Bob, when I build my statues, I will make sure I build one with both of us right outside.
Thank you.
I will use that as my excuse.
It does remind me of the joke that X-Men is ultimately just about a nasty breakup between Magneto and Charles that they made everybody else's problem.
That's probably what this is, Bob. And let me tell you this, too. At the end of the episode, the Xavier statue is completely destroyed, while the Magneto statue is beheaded. So I don't know if that has some symbolism, but...
Yeah, it shows that Magneto was right, son.
It shows that Magneto made the sacrifice of having his head decapitated while Professor X was off with his dream being crushed, like his statue. There you go.
This is definitely not the first time you've seen the Rogue Magneto romance, but I'd be wrong about this because I didn't revisit the late 80s that issue with Magneto in the Savage Land. But I think it's really the first time they've teased Rogue as a queen. I think that's usually a trope they more use for Storm, right? Given her being worshipped as a goddess in right. Some parts of the world and what have you. And so having Rogue treated as a queen or a potential queen was very interesting, I thought.
Yeah, I felt any Omega-level female mutant could probably be considered a queen at this point.
Yeah, it's true. Although, is Rogue really Omega-level?
I think
she can steal Omega. I mean, they threw up a list in House of X and Powers of 10, and I'm pretty sure Rogue wasn't on it. Oh. But, I mean, she could also easily steal an Omega's power.
Oh, so hell yeah. That's what I'm saying. If you can do that, it may automatically makes you one.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember, too, if the Sentinel, when it was targeting her, said Omega threat detected.
No, that was about Storm.
That was about Storm, but it was also about Magneto. Also about Magneto, too, in this episode. Yes.
Okay.
So, yeah, it was just the Wild Sentinel. I'm pretty sure it did not say it about Rogue, but it did say it about Magneto. So you're right. I don't think she's considered Omega at this point.
Yeah. Oh, and I will say, I'm actually not sure which would be more correct in this episode. I've heard it described as a Wild Sentinel and as a Tri-Sentinel.
It's a three-headed Sentinel with a bug body.
I mean, in as much as there can be a good Sentinel, it's a good Sentinel.
Interesting design.
To return for just a minute to, we have Scott emotionally cheating on Jean with Madeline, and we do have Jean's excellent bitter line, fine, go to Genosha, pee with my clone.
That line in this, Bob, is the one line you will never be able to use in real life, okay? We're going to start this, because that's the one line. And then next episode, I've got the perfect line for you that you will never be able to use in your actual life, but it's awesome. So we'll save that, but that's the one for this episode.
Well, Matt, I'm actually going to say, so I might have said this on air before, but in my doctoral program, one of the most profound things a professor ever said was we were talking about psychoanalysis, and he made the point that, yep, I always date the same guy. Then I break up with him, and then I find him again. And... That really spoke to both me and my friend Alan in a deep way. It's just, yeah, it is the same one every time, isn't it? It always is. And so I don't know what the other thinks, Matt, but I'm pretty sure for him or her, I or my boy are also the same every time. And so I might have occasion to say, go to an island and be with my clone. Okay. I don't rule that out for my future.
Well, here's what we'll do, Bob. We can take these weird lines. We'll justify them just like you did, because we may be able to justify the other ones as well. So
yeah, I have a strange emotional life, man. I can fit X-Men to it. I did want to say the other thing about Emma was, so the Madeline and Scott thing is obviously Emma and Scott in the Morrison comics, but it is funny that Emma is voyeuring on Scott and Madeline. So I like that as an homage to the Morrison run.
So, Bob, did you guess that it was Madeline before the reveal due to the hair?
I think I did. I think I did guess it was Madeline, because it wouldn't have worked with Emma, because there was no
prior relationship. They just don't have,
my memory is so distorted by rage and grief. I can't fully say Mad. I would have to rewatch.
Yeah, I'm just saying, everyone, watch out for the hair. It's the hair.
Watch out for the hair. Matt's on hair watch.
I'm on hair watch.
He is judging how a ginger does her hair.
No, I have no hair, so I focus on hair. That's what it boils down to.
Oh, man. Let's see. So, speaking of drama and emotions, Gambit does have a very self-righteous line when he's talking to Rogue that really amused me, which is, he's just, why don't you try telling Gambit the dang truth?
And Gambit totally hears the truth, Bob. I think he hears more than he wants, as he's tossing one cord after another into the fire. And then we get that fiery line that Rogue is totally going to go with Magneto. And then who does he throw in the fire? The Queen of Hearts. Oh, my God. Indeed. Right in the chest.
Indeed.
That is some... What is the word for that? Melodramatic.
Melodrama.
Melodrama. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know, man. A lot of people, I think they got won over by how this episode goes. But prior to this episode, a lot of people were complaining because they really like Rogue and Gambit as a couple, mm-hmm. which I love Rogue and Gambit as a couple too. But I really do like the Rogue Gambit Magneto triangle. I think they especially handled it pretty well in the 2000s. At one point, Gambit basically tells Magneto, you can play around with her all you want, but I know she's going to come back to you in the end.
Which, I mean, by the end of this episode, she does.
We have another interesting angle. After this, Madeline is somewhat comforting Gambit at the bar, and it seemed to me they're flirting a little bit, which is a very interesting couple, right? Like, there is that famous scene in, I believe it's the Morlock Christmas episode in the last season of X-Men 92, where Jean, who would have to have been Madeline, and Gambit are arguing about cooking Christmas dinner. And they're arguing, but there's also a sense of flirtation to it. So it is an interesting idea of a couple of Madeline and Gambit. I mean, obviously we don't get that explored because of what happens to Gambit, but it's an interesting prospect.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about that episode, Christmas with the Morlocks. We haven't covered that yet on Patreon, but we'll get there soon.
Yeah, we'll get there soon. We'll get there soon. And I mean, also, maybe I shouldn't bring this up because it just makes it weirder. But you know what the rumor about Gambit was in the early 90s, right?
That he was homosexual?
No. Although, I mean, people read Gambit as bi, which I think is very fair. No, the rumor in the early 90s was he was going to be the third Summers brother.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. It ended up being Vulcan, yeah. though, right?
It ended up being Vulcan, who they introduced in the early 2000s or mid-2000s. And actually, I think at first the rumor was it was Gambit, and then they switched it to that the rumor was it was Adam X the Extreme. And I think they actually maybe confirmed that Adam X the Extreme is a Summers brother in X-Men Unlimited comic too. That might have actually been confirmed too. Oh man, wild stuff. So that does actually add maybe a creepier dimension to the Madeline and Gambit flirting. Yeah, so we don't need to talk about that.
It really does. Yeah, let's just leave that out. Yeah, that's creepy. All right, Bob. So let's get back to your anger, Bob. The source of your anger is this Shaw and Frost thing. What's your beef here?
My beef is that, I mean, this is dark, but my read of the Shaw and Frost relationship is that Emma had to sleep with him early in the Hellfire Club, but she's powerful enough within the club and with her other resources that she would not sleep with him now. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense. Yeah. Yeah, they're an oddball couple there. But they were together though in the first season, the first series, in the original series. So I mean, maybe they were just trying to bring that over.
Were they?
Emma Frost, I know they didn't Emma show, or no, wasn't Emma in with the Hellfire Club?
Well, I mean, they're in the inner circle together. Yeah, together. But I don't know that they're together in any sense.
I mean, I always thought she was the White Queen, so he was the King. I just always put that together in my head. But maybe that's just me being a kid.
But I think when she starts at the Hellfire Club, probably Shaw does use his position in a cancelable way. But I think by the time she attains royal status in the Hellfire Club, I don't actually know how the Hellfire Club works, but as I picture it, all four of the monarchs have their own power bases within the club, and so their ability to coerce one another is limited.
Let's move on to Genosha, Bob.
There's a song you wanted to bring up.
We have Ace of Base just blasting away with the song Nation as Magneto and Rogue dance together.
Which is very 1997.
It was the most 1997 song they could pick, and it's the only place this could really work. Because if they would have dropped this and say, let's say Marvel drops an X-Men movie, and they try to do this, it would be the stupidest thing ever. But
yeah,
dropping
it in a period piece.
In a cartoon called X-Men 97, it works. But yeah, but while this music's playing, though, Bob, we get the best scene ever, which is...
Is this when Cable burst in?
That's right, Bob. Cable burst in. And what is Cable? What's the first thing coming out of Cable's mouth?
Well, he's yelling to turn off the music. And Matt, if you'll remember, we just read, I think it was X-Men 97 number one, the comic.
Correct.
And in that, we learn that in Bishop's future, Bishop is at a Dazzler concert, but we learn that in Bishop's future, music is criminalized. And that was my first thought is, oh man, in Cable's future, it's also criminalized. And so he's coming here to enforce the anti-music laws.
Bob, what if legislation is put into place? What if governments blame the fact that they were playing music during the Genosian massacre, and that's why the mutants didn't have time to get off the island? So that's why the entire nation just banned music.
I mean, what if they just banned Ace of Base, Matt?
That may be it, Bob. Maybe they banned Ace of Base.
That's why we don't hear it anymore. If Ace of Base were still legally allowed to be played, you could have it in your X-Men movie. But I mean, that's not the world we live in. It's criminalized.
They must have seen the sign, Bob. They saw the sign, and it opened up their eyes.
So Matt, I gotta ask, who's the he that's coming that Cable refers to?
Could it be Apocalypse? Could it be Cassandra Nova? Could it be... I say Cassandra Nova because maybe there's just a confusion between... Since that's his sister, but she's very like...
His twin sister,
but she... When you look at her, she looks alien, like in the comic. She's almost genderless, in my opinion.
She's non-binary,
possibly. Yeah. And that's never really been an issue in the comics with that. I mean, it's just... But...
It would be interesting because she was in the second Marauder series a lot, but I don't think they really played with that in the second Marauder series. Although, the second Marauder series was a half face turn for Cassandra Nova, which was very interesting.
And then also, could it just be like a bad Professor X? Remember the bad Professor X we got earlier in the Phoenix Saga? Maybe showing up.
Some other possibility. Oh yeah, when he has the cape. I think that's actually the Phoenix Saga and not the Dark Phoenix Saga.
It is. It's the Phoenix Saga.
I mean, I guess other possibilities might be Dark Beast and Mr. Sinister. I was wondering about Exodus's cameo on the island because it seemed a little out of character for Exodus, but I guess if they hadn't done the cameo and you had the scene with Cable, I might have wondered, oh, is the he Exodus?
Right, but if he's talking now, we do know that at the end of episode 6, spoilers, you haven't seen episode 6.
Yeah, it's
Sinister. However, is that who Cable is referring to though? Because we constantly see Cable shooting Apocalypse in the face in the intro.
In the 90s Cable solo comic and in the X-Men 92 Cable episodes, there's a big connection between Cable
right.
and
so,
Apocalypse.
I mean, is he referring to Apocalypse or is he referring to Sinister in this case?
There's also, I'll save it for episode 6, but there's another thing going around that makes me think it could be Apocalypse, too.
Okay. I'll wait eagerly for that, Bob.
All right. We already talked about the Wild Sentinel or the Tri-Sentinel, but the other thing we could call it would be what Gambit calls it, which is some vile Godzilla Sentinel.
The Godzilla Sentinel. That's like the best version. It's not Mechagodzilla, a Godzilla Sentinel.
A Godzilla. Very different. Very different. Man. So should we just skip to the death, Matt?
Yeah, let's go ahead and just talk about this death, Bob. It's time. It's time to get through this.
Oh, man.
Man, that's the sacrifice, Bob, brought me to tears.
Yeah, very sad, very sad. Well, and the great thing is, as soon as he's impaled on the rod, what he's going to do with it?
Oh, exactly. You're like, the Sentinel's stupid. Like, how did I have this in its programming? I mean, but it was amazing.
The Sentinel knows what its power is, but it doesn't understand how it works, possibly. Like some commenters on the internet.
Yeah, yes, Bob, to which I had to get in an argument with some guy on the internet, which is one of the reasons I've tried to stay away from social media for a while. I just feel like I just constantly have to argue with dumb people. Or I have to read things that just hurt my brain. So I just have to stop and give it up right now. But this person thought that Gambit's powers could only come from his hands, which maybe that is true, but still, it's skin-to-skin contact, and he has control over it, so it doesn't matter. Yeah, what else is he going to use? His foot? He start throwing cards with his feet? His hands are the most easiest way to do it.
Yeah. Well, and I didn't rewatch it again because I was too sad to rewatch it. But I think he might have even reached over with his hand.
He probably did. But
yeah.
The point, it was very clear what he does. He uses his power to charge it to blow the Sentinel up.
Yeah, God. Very much so.
People are so
dumb. It's such a perfect death though. And I don't know. I'm usually of the opinion that I don't like when superhero comics kill people usually, because I feel like it closes down stories. But this, or superhero shows, but this was such a good death. And we have Cable showing up, and then we have a cameo of the Watcher. And man, I part of me really doesn't want them to undo this death, even though it makes me so sad. It's like such a perfect death. What are you going to do with Gambit after killing him?
I know. They don't need to cheapen the sacrifice, but it's X-Men, Bob. And people come back from the dead all the time. This is not...
Oh, yeah. And I do expect that a lot of the people who seem to be dead in this episode either are not dead or are going to be resurrected by Cable time stuff. And I'm okay with that. But just the Gambit one is so spectacular that undoing it would make me sad.
Well, Bob, I will say that this final part with Gambit, this battle... has three of the best animated scenes in X-Men I have ever seen. Okay?
Hit us with the three.
So, Bob, Magneto using an entire train as a whip. That was cool.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was from a comic. I don't care. It was awesome.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well,
and also, given the themes and metaphors of the X-Men, very interesting reversal of iconography, too.
Right. And then... The next scene that's one of the best scenes in X-Men ever is Gambit going Akira style on that motorcycle, charging it, and then slamming it into Rogue to save her.
Which is great, especially because Rogue probably wouldn't have survived encounter with it either.
And of course, Bob, the actual sacrifice scene, if they would just make a statue of that, I'd put it on my coffee table. I'd buy two. I'd take one to work. I want that. I want the Tri-Sentinel with Gambit. And he's stuck in it. He's looking at him, and you can just start to see the charge. I want that statue. Make it. You'd sell a million.
Yeah, no, it's a great image, man. It's a great image.
Bob, it's not just Gambit who dies, though. We do have a couple of other characters that we think did not make it. And we did have some confirmation on who they want us to believe didn't make it based on the intro to episode 6. So you want to go through that list?
So we have Magneto appears to die with a bunch of Morlocks, including Leech. I don't believe that Magneto is dead, right? It's not very... It's vanishing in a ball of light type scenario, if I'm remembering right.
Right. He's not dead.
Right.
He's not in the intro. Yeah. So they want us to assume
he's dead. He's not in the
dead.
Intro to episode 6. Yeah, so they want us to assume he's dead. And it's also a very touching scene. You have Magneto comforting Leech in German at the end. It's very sweet. Then Banshee and Marrow are dead because they're blasted. Banshee's carrying Marrow, and they're blasted out of the sky by the Wild Sentinel. And then Madeline, Moira, Callisto, Sebastian Shaw, and Squid Boy all seem like they could be dead, especially Callisto and Squid Boy.
Right. You watch Callisto's pupils shrink, which is usually that's the sign that someone's dead.
We did have a cameo that I I noticed the cameo, but with Squid Boy, I didn't know who it was. But we have Bo DeMeo and his date. And so presumably Bo DeMeo is dead as well, which is ironic, right, given that his summary firing right before this show premiered. And again, just assuming he didn't do anything messed up, which it does not sound like he did. It sounds like Disney was just being weird. Why in the world did they fire him? It's insane.
Yeah, if he didn't cause harm to other people in any way, bring the man back for season three. Just, well, it'll be 2 years. Let's let him back. Nobody's going
to
care. Yeah.
What's the standard of harm? Was he rude to people on set? I don't care.
Yeah.
that's not my business. If he did something truly messed up, sure, fine, whatever. But we have no reason to believe that. The dominant rumor is that it was about dick pics on OnlyFans, which is, that's the man's personal business. Why Disney cares beyond me.
Exactly. But yeah. So Bob, I want to, one last thing before we close this chapter on the whole Gambit piece and this pretty much this episode. Prior to the final episode of the original run, Graduation Day, Xavier's last words to Gambit were this: "How often must a scoundrel prove himself a hero before he believes it himself?"
Yeah, which is also interesting because it adds a sense of needlessness to Gambit's death, right? It almost makes it seem like when you put those two things together that, like, Gambit just can't accept that he's a hero, and so he has to set himself up for this big death. I'm not necessarily saying I agree with this interpretation, but you could make the argument that Rogue's powers from Carol Danvers are enough that she'll survive the encounter with a Wild Sentinel.
Did he sacrifice himself just to try to prove himself a hero? I mean, he definitely did prove himself a hero for sure, but was the sacrifice necessary?
Yeah, was it necessary, or was it something because of his own self-esteem issues and his own grief about Rogue and Magneto that he felt he wanted to do? Yeah, I do like that it gives it an ambiguity, too. I mean, as cool of a death as it is, it's not like an unambiguous death in that sense. All right, so we were also going to talk about issue number 2, Matt, X-Men 97, the comic that came out the same day. And honestly, there's just, I mean, we're still traumatized by episode 5.
It was really hard to say. It was so hard to read this comic after this episode because it doesn't, the previous comic tied in really well to what was happening in that episode 3.
Well, and just to say, like, I'm really glad that I watched episode 3 and then I read issue number 1 in the order that I did because they also came out on the same day.
Right.
And number 1 has Mr. Sinister in it, and it was much cooler to have a Mr. Sinister reveal in episode 3 and then read number 1, which is a prequel, and see Mr. Sinister. That dynamic worked a lot better. Had it been reversed, I wouldn't have been happy. And I don't know if that was intentional or coincidental, but it certainly seemed like wild synergy. Whereas this does not seem super synergistic, right? Like, there's not a lot. I mean, there is one connection between the issue and the episode, but I really, really wished I had read issue number 2 before seeing episode 5, just for reasons of tone, right? Like, it was not very effective tone-wise to go from Gambit and Magneto's sacrifices to issue number 2, which was a perfectly fine issue, but not remarkable.
Yeah, it's literally just a fight between the X-Men and the Sinister Seven, or the Marauders. And that team consists of Hazard, Sienna Blaze, Riptide, Sabretooth, Arclight, Prism, and Harpoon. We see the X-Men face off against each of them. And then we do get to witness Scott finding out he's going to be a dad. So we did get to see that scene where he finally stops and listens to Madeline for at least 5 seconds to find out that he's a father. And this doesn't sit well with Wolverine, who storms off. And then, ironically, Storm comes and helps him and tries to make him feel better.
We end with the reveal that Sabretooth is Morph, although it's a little unclear. Has Morph been Sabretooth the entire time, or did he just slip in during the fight, or has he been impersonating Sabretooth for a couple months? It's not super clear. But I will say the connection is that we've talked before about how X-Men 97 is taking things from the Grant Morrison run, but it's also taking things from the late 80s Claremont run. And we basically see like a mutant massacre on Genosha, right? Which is a big late 80s X-Men crossover. And it's the Marauders in the comics who do the mutant massacre. And so it's interesting that episode 5 is the mutant massacre. And issue 2 has the original team that did it. Also, just worth noting that although Hazard and Sienna Blaze are working with the Marauders, or seem to be a part of the Marauders in number 2, traditionally they're not Marauders. Hazard is a guy with some connections to Xavier's past, and Sienna Blaze is one of the upstarts, and they're both early 90s X-Men villains, whereas the Marauders are late 80s X-Men villains.
Well, Bob, I guess it's going to be really hard for us to choose our character of the week here, right?
Who could it be? Who could it be? Oh, right, it's Gambit. Yeah. Duh. I will say, though, obviously it's Gambit, but, man, Nightcrawler, Rogue, Magneto, Leech, Madeline, Cyclops, all great. All had a great week.
Yeah, a lot of good characters in this. Man, I'm so glad that they made this show.
I had some worries, especially because I don't think Bodomeo and I see eye to eye on Emma Frost, but he's really good at his job, and the writers working with him are really good at their job. I'm very impressed.
Yeah, I just didn't have faith in Disney, I think was the problem.
Well, and they hadn't given you a lot of reason for faith, if you think back to about how bad Moon Knight was.
Well, even with animation, like the What If stuff is just not that good to me. I don't really enjoy it.
Yeah, I was annoyed because I only watched the first season of What If, and people were saying you probably needed to have seen it to see Doctor Strange 2. And
no.
I really liked Doctor Strange 2, but no. I mean, this in fairness to these people, they were guessing. This was before the movie was out. But yeah, no, you didn't need to. And so I was very irritated that I watched a whole season of What If for no real reason.
Well, Bob will be moving on to episode 6. That cover should be, we should be releasing that the same week this is coming out. So good for you guys.
Yeah, I'm gonna do an editing barrage right after this. So join us for episode 6 on our public feed. Join us on our Patreon feed for X-Men 92 versus Young Justice. Like we said, we just dropped the Nightcrawler episode. You're going to want to hear about Wolverine finding Christ in Notre Dame, even though the way I was brought up, Catholics weren't Christians. But I mean, that's just how I was brought up. So anyway, this is X-Men 97 on Uncanny Treks. I'm Bob in Cascadia. That's Matt in the Southland. Have a great night, everybody.
Thanks for listening.